Good afternoon. Let's call the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee to order. Let the record reflect that there is a quorum. All five members are here, starting on my left, Senator Bundy, and then Senator Davis, and on my right, Senator Meyer and Senator Thomas, and myself, Senator Pascafan. Let the record reflect it's about 1:13 p.m. on Tuesday, April 14th today, day before Tax Day, in the labor and commerce sense, so make sure everyone's gotten their taxes done. The purpose of our meeting today is to take up the following legislation, Senate Bill 12, limiting overtime for registered nurses, the committee substitute for Senate Bill 126, which is a reemployment of retirees exempt service bill, and then House Bill 93, the Do Not Call Registry, committee substitute for House Bill 101. This is on the exemptions, life insurance, annuities bill. And lastly, the committee substitute for House Bill 102, which is a uniform commercial code. Thank everyone for being here today, whether they are live here in person or over the internet or the off-net connections. We do have a full agenda today, and it's my intent to hear and move the bills today if we can. We will begin, I believe, again, we're in Senate Bill 12. This is the nurses' overtime bill. I believe that we do have a committee substitute and would call for a motion to bring that committee substitute before this committee and then ask Mr. Obermeyer to be prepared to explain to us what the committee substitute is all about.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Thomas.
I would move that the CS for Senate Bill number 12, version backslash E, I think that's correct, be brought before the committee as our working document.
Mm-hmm. Is there any objections to bringing backslash E committee substitute before this committee? Seeing none, the committee substitute for Senate Bill 12 is before this committee, and Mr. Obermeyer, would you please identify yourself, state your affiliation, and walk us through the committee substitute.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tom Obermeyer, aide to Senator Davis. The committee substitute for Senate Bill 12 before you is the 26LS0075 backslash E as an echo, dated April 10th, 09. This is an act relating to limitations on mandatory overtime for registered nurses and licensed practical nurses in healthcare facilities. The change that was made, or there were two changes made in the bill to require the CS, and they were both exceptions to the overtime provisions of the bill. The first one is on page 3, lines 19 all the way through to page 4, line 3. And this addresses the exception for the 16-hour shifts at psychiatric residential treatment hospitals, psychiatric treatment centers, and secure residential psychiatric treatment centers. This accommodates the modified Baylor plan that was described at the North Star Behavioral Facilities. The second exception is to is on page 5, line 31, through page 6, line 4. It's section 18.20.460. It's a new section that is titled Provisions Not Applicable to Nurses Employed in Federal or Tribal Facilities, and it explains that this bill does not apply to the federal government or tribal organizations defined under the statutory provisions of the U.S. Code. And in doing this, the drafter also took out the word federal in the definition of healthcare facility because it really didn't apply to the way it was organized here. On lines 8 and 16 of page 6, where it said under 1820.469 definitions, healthcare facility defined as a private, municipal, or state, or federal hospital. They took out federal. They did the same thing with the same wording on line 16. And it was thought by the drafter that it'd be better to have a separate provision exempting this particular group rather than including it under the long enumerated exceptions on page 2 of the bill. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Senator Bundy.
Thank you. I'm just wondering about that, the need to include that last provision. Certainly not an attorney, but I thought federal law would trump state law in any case, and that so our state laws would not be applicable to a federal hospital. And so I'm just wondering why you had to make the exemption.
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, this issue had come up in the previous version last year where the native facilities were very concerned that they be exempted, and they felt that although we put it in the bill that we anticipated that it would be included, we wound up with opposing legal arguments. One was on their side saying that presumably federal law preempts, and on the other side it was determined that since these are licensed facilities by the state that they would apply to these facilities. So rather than get an argument about it again this year, it was determined that it might be better just to exempt them because many of these facilities are run adequately in the more rural areas. The larger facilities in the cities are already accounted for. So I don't know if that would answer the question, but we have addressed that legal issue before.
Okay, thank you. Just follow up then. And it isn't that they have different work schedules and work their nurses less overtime. It's simply because of the federal-state conflict.
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
And Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Mr. Obermeyer. Mr. Obermeyer, could you explain to me again the amendment or the change you made pertaining to the Baylor plan?
If you go to page 3 and on line 19, it states that number 8 is the beginning of this long section, that a nurse who is employed at a psychiatric treatment hospital that treats only adolescents and children, it's a restrictive provision, at a residential psychiatric treatment center under this statutory provision of 1807 and 4712, and at a secure residential psychiatric treatment center, that if they voluntarily work a 16-hour shift for the period between 5 on Friday and 8 on Monday, that immediately follows and receives pay and benefits of that worker equal or greater than the pay or benefits a nurse would receive for working 20 hours in the same position, and during that period does not work a 16-hour shift consecutive with another shift of 8 hours or more without an intervening break of 8 hours. So what they're saying, this modified Baylor plan that was originally a 12-hour weekend plan by Baylor University was modified to make it two, instead of two 12-hour shifts, two 16-hour shifts. It was agreed to that although this seems like extremely large, long hours under our present bill, that these facilities are not necessarily as requiring the acute care that will occur in many other facilities that require surgery and that type of thing. So although it seems an unusual exemption, the Nurses Association, it's my understanding, would feel that this is all right to go along with, in addition and in fact for both exemptions. And it's nothing that they would want to do make any exceptions, but for the most part this seems to be more workable.
If I may, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, absolutely.
So I think I heard you answer this question. My question was why you're limiting it just to psychiatric institutions. And I think you said because the care is not as acute as at a regular hospital. And I guess my concern here is that what if you had Providence, I'll use them since they're going through negotiations right now, this would prohibit them from even negotiating a Baylor plan.
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, I'm not aware that it would prevent them from having a Baylor plan. In fact, they work separate hours already. They work three 12-hour shifts that are not considered overtime as a full-time 40-hour work week. This doesn't prevent other types of Baylor plans from being worked, but it's not encouraging 16-hour shifts in Providence Hospital, even though they probably have a couple, probably more than one psychiatric unit, because they take about 4,000 patients in a year, I understand, under that basis. So I really don't have an answer. This exemption was basically designed for the North Star facility, or facilities in Anchorage.
Yeah, and that's
adolescence.
Mr. Chairman, and I understand that and I appreciate that, but I think the way that the bill's written now, it would prohibit other non-psychiatric hospitals from going to a 16-hour workday too, if they so desired.
Through the chair, I don't have the drafter online to answer that question, but I could probably get an answer.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Davis.
I don't know necessarily if it would be the drafter that would answer that, but we can get him on there. But there are some people from the Nurses Association that could address that. This was in the bill before, and it was acceptable by all concerns, and that was including Providence. I'm not so sure that this would preclude them from having a 16-hour shift if they wanted to have that. This is just the ones that approached us and say it was working for them. They're already using it. That's why it was designed for that North Star group. But there's also one of the hospitals that's using the plan like that. That's at Regional. They have, I don't know how many hours they work, but they work like a 30-hour week in a weekend time, similar to what we have here. So if they can do that, I can't understand why it would preclude Providence from doing the same.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not going to belabor this, and I may just be reading it wrong, but the way I read this, if somebody wants to work a 16-hour workday, that would only be acceptable at a residential or at a psychiatric treatment hospital. So, but it's not that big an issue that I'm going to hold it up for, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Any further questions for Mr. Obermeyer? We closed public testimony on this the last time we heard this bill, so I believe we're ready to have this bill with this committee substitute before us. I think we're ready to move this. Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that committee substitute for Senate Bill number 12, version /E, be moved to the next committee of referral with individual recommendations. And is there a fiscal note even attached?
I believe that.
There's a couple of them, but
yeah.
With attached fiscal notes.
Any objection? Seeing none, the committee substitute for Senate Bill 12 is moved from Senate Labor and Commerce. We'll take a brief at ease for signing. Three of us on this committee were part of that previous State Affairs Committee. Labor and Commerce back to order. We now have before us the committee substitute for Senate Bill 126. This was the committee substitute out of the State Affairs Committee. This is the Reemployment of Retirees Exempt Service Bill. I know three of us on this committee were part of that previous State Affairs Committee, but well, we hadn't had the time, I believe, to open that up for public testimony. Is there anyone here in the audience that would care to speak
on that here, or is there anyone off net that would care to come forward? And is there anyone off net on? All right, seeing none, I will close public testimony. Prepared for a motion, whether Senator Bundy.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I move SB 126 from committee with Patch fiscal notes, individual recommendations.
That's the committee substitute?
Yeah, I'm sorry, committee substitute. I'm
bring it before us first, right?
I think that's what we received. Do we need to bring it before us again?
I thought it was the first look at it.
So the committee substitute for 126 is what was before us to begin with.
Okay. Mm. He's right.
So then, Senator Bundy, is your motion that to why don't you restate your motion so that
move.
Madam Clerk is very clear.
Move the committee substitute for SB 126 from committee with individual recommendations.
Okay. I'll object for purposes of discussion.
Yes, Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And you're right. We heard this in State Affairs and had heard it briefly here. If I recall, that the major changes were, though, that we were going to wait. They'd have to wait 90 days instead of 6 months.
Correct.
I just wonder if maybe you could, you or staff, could go through some of the major changes, just to refresh my memory.
Senator Meyer, in my memory, and not indicating it's complete, but I believe that there were a number of, if you look at, I believe in your packet is the original Senate bill, where on page one they had like director, deputy director, petroleum investment manager. They eliminated a number of those categories, and then they reduced the waiting period from 90 days, or excuse me, 6 months to 90 days, and we did that at Senator Kukek's suggestion. There is a bill comparison that is dated April 7th, 2009, I believe, in your packet.
Here, I can provide this to you. Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And then obviously the other major change was going from 4 years to 1 year.
Yes, exactly. Where the sunset on this is June 30, 2010, so next year.
Mr. Chairman, I remove my objections. Thank you for the clarification.
Any further discussion on the committee substitute for Senate Bill 126? Prepared for to receive a motion, then with respect to...
I removed my objection.
Okay, so...
I've made the motion, the objection's removed, we're good to go.
Okay, so I take it then that there are no objections to advancing the motion to move the committee substitute for Senate Bill 126 out of this committee. Seeing none, it is so moved, and we'll take a brief at ease for signing. Senate Labor and Commerce back to order. We now Senate Labor and Commerce back to order. We now have before us House Bill number 93. Believe that this is Representative Chenault's bill, and we recognize Representative Chenault's staff, and so if please identify yourself, state your affiliation, and please commence your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name's Tom Wright. I'm staff to Speaker Chenault, who apologizes. Couldn't be here this afternoon. They're still on the floor, so he sent me in his stead. I'm not going to say this is a simple bill, because every time I say that, we always run into a million questions. But what House Bill 93 does is add a cellular or mobile telephone to the definition of telephone solicitation as defined under AS 45-5475-G. And what this bill does in essence is add cellular mobile phones to the unlawful and wanted telephone advertisements and solicitation section. There is a national do not call registry that's operated by the Federal Trade Commission. It's been in service since 2003. And the service allows a consumer to register their telephone or cell or mobile phones to that list should a consumer wish to limit telemarketing calls. Quite simply, what this bill does is put state statute in compliance with federal law. And there has been some questions about whether cell phones numbers would be available to the public. At this time, they are not. But there are several services at this time, mostly in the lower 48, that are getting cell phone numbers, and they're going to put them in a directory for their use. And at some point, if that directory ever does become public, then it would be subjected to telemarketing calls. And what we're trying to do is stay ahead of the curve a little bit. This bill is more proactive than reactive. And so that's why the speaker introduced this bill, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Any questions, Senator Thomas?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tom, in this case, since I missed the time frame for the telephone at home, do I get another bite at the apple with this? I'm able to put my name on the registry now and include my home phone as well as my cell phone?
Mr. Chairman, that's my understanding, yes.
That's what I thought. Thank you.
Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Is there anyone in the audience that would wish to testify regarding House Bill 93, the Do Not Call Registry? Anyone online? We will close public testimony on House Bill 93. Any discussion in the committee? Call for a motion.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that House Bill 93 version backslash A, I believe, is the version we're working off of, be moved to the next committee of referral with individual recommendations and the attached fiscal note.
Are there any objections? Seeing none, it is so ordered. We will.
Hey,
thank
Tom.
You.
Tom, tell Chenault that's two.
We'll call Senate Labor and Commerce back to order. We now have before us the committee substitute, I believe out of the Judiciary, for House Bill 101 dealing with life insurance and exemptions and annuities. And so
please identify, the sponsor would please identify themselves and state their affiliation and provide the testimony.
My name is Amanda Mortensen, and I'm staff representative Coghill. And HB 101 exempts the full value of life insurance and annuities from being attached to by creditors in the case of liabilities. This bill would protect Alaskan families and their ability to plan for their future. For example, if person A was to hit person B with a car, person B could sue for the assets of person A. This bill would protect person A's life insurance and annuity contracts so that their family can still survive on their own. It does not prevent person B from being able to garnish person A's other assets in order to fulfill the settlement. It also protects the death benefit of a spouse or a dependent of the debtor in the case that the person is not yet deceased. Currently, retirement plans are creditor protected under federal laws. This bill would help if an employee was working for an employer who did not offer a retirement plan. The employee could use an annuity as a retirement plan and provide themselves and their families with better financial security. With the uncertainty of the Social Security system, Alaskan families need to be able to legitimately plan for their future. This bill falls under Title 38, the Alaska Exemptions Act. It then falls under Section 15, Property Exempt Without Limitation. Section 1 adds unmatured life insurance and annuity contracts owned by the individual to the list of property exempt without limitation. Section 2 removes the words or payable in order to clarify a potential ambiguity regarding trying to garnish a death benefit on an individual who has not passed away yet. Section 3 is repealed because there is no longer any reason to have a section dedicated to the exemption of unmatured life insurance and annuity contracts, since they now fall under the category of property exempt without limitation in AS 09.38.015. Section 4 is an applicability section that states that this will only apply to a debt that is created on or after the effective date of this act. And as of May 2007, 10 states exempt life insurance and annuities 100% from creditors. I also have Linda Holbert on the line from New York Life and Dennis Bailey from Legislative Legal if there are any questions.
Senator Bundy.
Yeah, thank you. In developing the bill, did you have any concern that this might encourage people to be irresponsible? If I might continue, we had a conversation earlier about you seem to worry about worst-case scenarios, but I can see someone who has a multi-million-dollar life insurance policy and he wrecks my $10,000 car and doesn't care because his multi-million-dollar life insurance policy is covered, is protected. It seems a bit unfair.
Through the chair, Senator Bundy. The intent here isn't to allow anybody to hide money or to be deceitful. In one of the states, Florida, actually, that protects life insurance and annuities, there have actually been court cases brought against individuals who have been trying to hide money or avoid paying bills, and they've lost because it was not a legitimately planned purchase or stash of money. If you had any more technical insurance questions, I would probably refer to Linda Holbert on the line.
Mr. Chairman, if I might. I guess I was thinking it as not as planning to hide your assets, but not being terribly concerned about your responsibilities because your assets were already protected. Did you give any thought to, now I could see a life insurance of $40,000 or $50,000 that's going to be provide some basic coverage for survivors. But did you give any thought to upper limits and when you $1 million, $2 million worth of life insurance? I'm not sure why that should be protected from debts that were acquired and the debtor having a reasonable expectation of being able to have their debt solved.
Through the chair, Senator Bundy. I think that we were just looking at the fact of trying to provide for Alaskan families. We weren't really looking at someone who was careless or I could have Linda Holbert address the question too. Thought about this a lot.
Mr. Chairman, I have more confidence in the good faith of Alaskans than I do apparently.
Any further questions of Amanda from Representative Coghill's office? We do have Linda Holbert from Fairbanks that is available. So, and Mandy, you feel comfortable to stay there. If you could, Linda, if you could please identify yourself, state your affiliation, and provide your testimony, and if you can respond to Senator Bundy's question, that would be wonderful.
Certainly, I will do my best. My name is Linda Holbert. I've resided in Fairbanks for the last 40 years. I've spent 20 years in the field of adult education and employment and training, and the last 19 years I've been with New York Life. I help families plan for the future, and I'd like to testify in favor of this bill because I think it's very important for Alaskans today to have the opportunity to plan, both for the well-being of their families and for their future in retirement, given today's marketplace and what's happening. It is very important today because most employers or many employers have stopped their contributions to 401k plans. Defined benefit plans are not readily available anymore. People have to assume individual responsibility for their retirement. And they also need to assume responsibility to plan for their families, for their children, for their grandchildren, for their spouses, so that if something unfortunate happens to them, they have the opportunity to continue and have a life. And life insurance is one of the ways to do it, and annuities is another way that they can put money away and save for retirement. We have available in 10 other states the opportunity to use this as a planning tool. In Alaska, we can use this as a planning tool, but it has many limitations. And so we're asking that people be allowed in Alaska like they do in New York, in Kansas, in Arizona, in Texas, in Florida, to have the opportunity to use this as planning tools where they can regard them in relative safety for planning purposes. I'd like to address Senator Bundy's concern. Most people who have multi-million dollar life insurance policies in Alaska are term policies where there really is no cash value available. People who normally have large insurance policies with cash value in also have numerous other assets. The asset in life insurance is primarily aimed at protecting their family and children for the future. And so I think this is a scenario that's very unlikely to play a part in the situation. If anyone were to use a life insurance policy or annuity as a fraudulent transfer to avoid an obligation, then that would be declared null and void, and they would not have creditor protection. Also, an individual can collaterally assign a life insurance policy, and then that would give the cash value and the death benefit available to the creditor. But in order to help people plan, I feel that this is really sound public policy. There may be a very, very, very isolated solution, but normally people who have substantial money in life insurance have numerous other unprotected assets which can be used. So I guess I would address it in that fashion. If people had a lot of money, they could set up a trust and put something into a trust, and then it wouldn't be subject to the use of their creditors either. So we're just asking for most Alaskan families that they have this so that they can use it for planning purposes for the future. More and more today, people are asked to accept responsibility for themselves, and employers aren't necessarily responsible for people anymore. People need to plan for themselves, and this is simply going with the tide of what's happening in many other states and allowing Alaskans more opportunities to plan for themselves. So with that, I'd be glad to answer questions. And Senator Bundy, I don't know if that's answered your question, but I tried.
Senator Bundy has at least one more, I'm sure, additional question.
Thank you. I guess you piqued my curiosity. You say, of course, a term life doesn't have any cash value. Certainly, if someone were to pass away, a term life of $1 million would have $1 million, at least before taxes, right?
That is correct.
Yeah. So what you were referring to is perhaps someone who has a bad debt and someone's trying to collect from their whole life if they chose to invest at that low rate. And any cash value that whole life might have accrued before they had passed away.
To the chair, yes, that is correct. Oh. The death benefit is something that a creditor would have to attach if they wish to try.
Okay, thank you. And if I might, Mr. Chairman, how often has it happened that someone's had their cash value of their life insurance attached to pay a bad debt?
I cannot answer that question. I don't have any personal knowledge that that's happened. It simply could happen. And for people who plan, it's especially important in retirement situations where a person in, say, accepts a retirement from a union and they get a life insurance policy to protect their spouse and maximize their pension. It would be really disastrous if that person were to lose that life insurance because their spouse then loses their retirement. So it's an important planning tool that we need to help people with.
Any further questions for Linda Hulbert? No further questions. I see there's Dennis Bailey with Legislative Legal is available. Mr. Bailey, are there any comments that you would, I notice you're available for questions. Are there any comments that you would like to make? Dennis Bailey, are you there?
I've just been unmuted, and yes, Mr. Chairman, I am available for questions, but no, I have no comments or prepared testimony.
Any questions of the committee of Mr. Bailey? Thank you, Mr. Bailey. There are no questions. Anyway, are there anyone else off-net that would like to testify? Is there anyone here in the room that would like to testify? We'll close public testimony on House Bill 101. And any discussion of the committee? Senator Bundy.
With all due respect to the bill's sponsor, this seems like a solution in search of a problem. And I'm still harbor some reservations about people who are irresponsible and then trying to protect some of their assets from being available to address their responsibilities. But apparently no one's been impoverished by having to have their life insurance cash value attached. I often worry about unintended consequences, I guess. So I'm really questioning why people who might abuse this need the protection at this point.
Senator Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, I like the bill. I'm kind of perplexed too as to I just don't know. So I'm hoping somebody can give me the answer. But if somebody has a long-term illness, let's say they're suffering from cancer, and so they rack up quite a bit of medical bills, doctor bills, etc., but they do have $1 million term life insurance. So then, can the hospital then come back after the estate to collect some of these hospital and doctor costs, in which case the life insurance would obviously go to the estate?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, that would be a question I would probably ask Linda Hulbert. I've personally never dealt with life insurance or who gets what in terms of someone dying and having those bills. She may be able to, if she's still on the line, she may be able to answer that.
Okay. Thank you. I'm just curious. It's just
No, I think that's a good question. Linda, are you still available?
Yes, I certainly am.
Senator Meyer presented a question. Did you hear that question?
I did hear the question, and I think I'd like to address it in two parts. Most life insurance policies today, at least most quality life insurance policies today, sold in the state of Alaska, have something which you can add called a living benefits rider. If an individual adds a living benefits rider and is terminally ill, they have access to the death benefit of their policy early. And so if somebody needed medical care and was at the tail end of life or needed hospital attention, you can actually access the death benefit of a policy early so that you can actually take care of some of those bills or make additional medical treatment available to that individual. It depends, and please excuse me, I am not an attorney, but what I would say is it depends on who the policy's beneficiary is. If somebody does die Frequently, the beneficiary is the estate of the insured. If the estate is the beneficiary of the policy, then the money would go into the estate and then would be subject to the claims of any creditors to the estate. If the beneficiary were an individual, like children or a spouse, the benefits of that policy would be, after the submission of a death certificate, go directly to that spouse and to those children. If there were estate taxes due to be paid, those heirs could be requested to utilize that policy to pay for estate taxes. But in general, in most situations, the benefit of the policy is paid directly from the insurance company to the named beneficiaries. That's why it's so important to check your named beneficiaries occasionally.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman,
I'm sorry. Senator Meyer, I believe in my understanding, and again, life insurance law is not my area of expertise, but specifically I think that what Linda Holbert has pointed out is the benefit of making sure your life insurance beneficiary is named as a specific person as compared to the estate, so that that way it will pass outside of probate with some attachments or strings, for the use of the current terminology. For example, you may have to invade that to pay estate taxes to the federal government, if applicable.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and that does help a lot. And obviously, I don't want to make this any more complicated. It's a good bill, but I would imagine you could run into problems too if it's going to a trust versus an estate versus a beneficial or beneficiary. So. But we don't need to go there. Thank you.
Senator Thomas had a question.
Just another little wrinkle in it. In your mind, Linda, do you believe that if somebody had a problem, had an accident or something, and then rushed out and bought a policy, would they be protected by this language, or would you think that they would probably be held responsible and seen in that case that they were trying to hide assets?
You stated it very well, absolutely. This cannot be used to fraudulently hide money, fraudulently transfer money. Any knowledge of or expectation that there was a creditor issue, any transference would be null and void. So the creditor protection is lost if there's any attempt at a fraudulent transfer whatsoever. So this only protects legitimate planning processes of people who set things in motion to protect their families and to protect their retirement. That is the main gist of this, and I certainly feel strongly, and I'm hopeful that you will support this bill. Does that answer your question, Senator Thomas?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Bundy.
Yeah, going back to Senator Meyer's example, and I think that's the problem with this bill. Someone who racked up a great deal of medical expense passed away, this bill would not allow the cost of that medical care to be attached from their life insurance benefits. And I'm not saying that that is a common thing, but it's a contingency that concerns me. Or that, not specifically the illness, but the idea that, hey, I'm old. I'm going to die pretty soon. I can be as careless as I want because they can't get my life insurance.
May I respond?
Linda Holbert, did you have a, I don't know that it was a question, but did you have a response?
I do. This bill in no way affects access to the death benefit, really.
Would you repeat that?
Yes. If somebody dies right now, and their named beneficiary is alive, the money right now goes directly to that named beneficiary. This doesn't affect, it doesn't affect accessibility to death benefit by a court suit if somebody else is your beneficiary. Am I explaining myself correctly? This bill does not change that.
I agree as to that statement.
Yeah, and if I might, Mr. Chairman, so what you're trying to protect is the cash value of a policy as well as an annuity, not the what remains after someone passes away.
primarily. I think that's the major concern, because if you take away the cash value, the death benefit no longer exists. The cash value is what supports the death benefit in a permanent life insurance policy. Amanda, or perhaps our attorney who wrote the bill, would be helpful in expressing that here. They might express it better.
The chair, I would defer to Dennis Bailey if he had an answer. He was on the line. Okay. I think he still is, maybe.
Well,
this is Dennis Bailey. I've just been unmuted, and I guess I'm not quite sure what the question is. The bill, or let me take a shot at it. The bill addresses the unmatured value of a life insurance or annuity contract. So I think the statement that it does not affect the death benefit is correct. And there's a variety of situations where the death benefit may go to someone other than the estate. It may go to an individual. And I think that Senator Bundy is correct that it would not be available for collection by a an injured person in an accident.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Now I believe I understand.
Any further questions for Mr. Bailey, Ms. Hulbert, or the bill sponsor? Seeing none, what is the wish of the committee? Senator Meyer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move that we move CS to House Bill 101 Judiciary from committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note.
Any objections thereto? Seeing none, the CS for House Bill 101 is moved from this committee. We'll take a brief at ease for purposes of signing.
Senate Labor and Commerce back to order. We now have before us a committee substitute for House Bill 102. I believe the committee substitute is out of the judiciary. And what I have in front of me is identified as backslash S, making sure that we're all on the same page. But we have before us Allison, I believe, staff to Representative Max Grunberg. And so if you could please identify yourself, state your affiliation, and then try to get us through the Uniform Commercial Code updates.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Allison Lafine. I'm staff to Representative Max Grunberg. Thank you for hearing House Bill 102 this afternoon. House Bill 102 amends Alaska statutes to reflect the recent revisions to Articles 1 and 7 of the Uniform Commercial Code. I'm actually going to turn it over to Terry Thurman, who is one of the Alaska commissioners, who will provide the committee with a brief overview and sectional analysis of the revisions. There are also two non-UCC provisions in the bill that I can speak to after Ms. Thurman is done with the bulk of the bill are the UCC revisions, and she can describe those much better than I can.
All right. Well, thank you, Allison. This is Terry Thurman.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Terry Thurman. I am one of Alaska's law commissioners, along with Lynn Levengood of Fairbanks and Mike Garrity of Anchorage. I'm considered a public member. I don't have anything to do with my regular day job, which some of you may know me from in this capacity. And in addition, Deborah Bear is the Department of Law representative. Justice Walter Carpinetti is the court system representative. And we have two life members, Grant Callow of Anchorage and Art Peterson of Juneau and other parts. And we make up the delegation of attorneys and judges from Alaska who represent the state before the or with the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws, which we are these days calling the Uniform Law Commission for short. It's a little easier. And the Uniform Commercial Code updates was our priority legislation this year, in large part because it is simply cleanup legislation in order to bring us up to date in sort of into the modern age, if you will, with electronic documents of title with respect to bills of lading and warehouse receipts, sort of for the transportation industry, as well as some of the general provisions that we've had on the books in Alaska in our Uniform Commercial Code for a long time. And it may seem like an overwhelmingly large bill because it's 60 some odd pages, but the Uniform Commercial Code parts, which I should give you the caveat now, are the only ones I'm speaking to, sections 8 and forward, not the additional amendments to other parts of the law that were added in the committee substitute. Those provisions are, by and large, changes in terminology and changes made to make the various provisions of our Uniform Commercial Code consistent with a handful of substantive changes that are made. It's divided into two parts, essentially, in the Uniform Law Conference's world, and that is Article 1, which is general provisions, and it covers things like definitions and obligations of good faith and that sort of thing, and then Article 7, which is the warehouse receipts and bills of lading and documents of title provisions. And I'd be happy to give you, you know, the real brief overview. I'm not sure a sectional would be all that useful, though I'd give it a shot if you want me to try. But I need to say for the record, we have Professor Bill Henning, who from the University of Alabama School of Law, who I think has been involved in the drafting process and is much more of an expert on Uniform Commercial Code than I am for any really technical questions. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I ask, do you want me to talk a little bit more about the guts of what the revisions do?
I think the brief presentation would probably be satisfactory at this point in time, and then we could call Professor Hennings for his observations after that. So I think a brief kind of why are we here type of statement.
All right. Well, I like to, when I talk about this bill, I like to start with the warehouse and bills of lading and documents of title provisions, because in a nutshell, and that's Article 7 of the UCC, it starts a fair way back in the bill. Those deal with almost entirely with bringing us into the modern age when it comes to shipping and transportation and how you transfer title amongst parties and show evidence of title. It's bringing us into the modern electronic age. Some of those provisions have been originally developed in the early 1900s, and the last time until this revision that the Uniform Commercial Code Article 7 provisions were updated was, I think, in 1951. And in 2003, the Uniform Law Commission came up with these revisions, and in the meantime, a good number of states, I think on this article we have 32 states that have already adopted these revisions, and in addition to ourselves, we have three other states that have introduced legislation to do so this year. So we're on the way to truly having uniformity on warehouse receipts and bills of lading and documents of title. But it's mainly meant to deal with electronic age issues. The general provisions, starting back in the earlier part of the bill, was Section 8, which are part of Article 1 of the Uniform Commercial Code, and they're sort of peppered throughout Title 45 of our statutes. As I said earlier, some of it is just terminology and conforming amendments, but there were about a half dozen sort of substantively important things that those revisions did to the Uniform Commercial Code. Now, those revisions date to 2001. They've been out a little bit longer. 35 states have already enacted those, and as in addition to us, there are three other states they're working on bringing those on this year as well. And the kinds of things they did were in some ways what you might call cleanup of the Uniform Commercial Code itself, some clarifications on the scope of coverage to make it really clear that these provisions are applicable only to UCC covered transactions. There was a little bit of fuzzy language with regard to, for example, the statutes of fraud requirement that or the statute of frauds requirement, which governs when an agreement has to be in writing. That was a little bit fuzzy previously and appeared to apply to transactions outside the Uniform Commercial Code context. So they fixed that. They also fixed the rules on choice of law, so that the parties to an agreement can choose the law of whichever jurisdiction they want to apply. It can be just a matter of sort of a free choice and agreement with some limitations meant to protect consumers so that they'd have the protection of their own state's laws and a few other sort of public policy related provisions. And then there was a little handful of other what you might call substantive changes in the middle here. A clarification or revision of the definition of good faith in the context of UCC to mean honesty in fact and the observance of reasonable commercial standards for a fair dealing, clarifying use of evidence of course of performance of a contractual arrangement in addition to the uses of trade and the course of dealings. And so I know by now I'm probably putting everybody to sleep with these esoteric details about how commercial transactions are governed, but the bottom line on this bill and these two articles that we're seeking to update in the Uniform Commercial Code is just to bring Alaska into the fold of the critical mass of nearly all the states that are using the same version of the Uniform Commercial Code provisions in these two areas, general provisions and warehouse receipts. That was probably longer than you intended.
No, that was very useful for me. It was 30 years ago that I took a UCC course in law school, so I don't practice UCC law, but it's always interesting to get Alaska up to date in the 21st century. So anyway, are there any questions for Terry Thurbin by any of the committee members? We would then call Professor Bill Hennings. Are you available?
Yes, I'm right here.
Please identify yourself, state your affiliation, and then provide your testimony.
Yes, certainly. It's a pleasure to be with you. My name is Bill Henning. I guess William, probably for the record, but it's Bill. I teach law at the University of Alabama School of Law, as Terry indicated. I've been a commissioner since 1994, and I was executive director of the Uniform Law Commission from 2001 to 2007, which is when these two acts were finally produced. And I teach in the area of the Uniform Commercial Code, so I'm in the classroom and in my research working with these kinds of provisions every day. In terms of my affiliation for purposes of this testimony, I am now an Alabama commissioner, just as Terry and others are Alaska commissioners, and so I'm speaking on behalf of the Uniform Law Commission.
Thank you. Are there additional comments that you would like to make? And one of the areas that I'm interested in are the electronic documentation or electronic signatures, and how that is all up to the 21st century standards.
Yes, I'll be glad to address that. Over the last 20 years, the Uniform Commercial Code has been revised from one end to the other to accommodate it to electronic transactions and to accommodate it to the use of electronic documents.
Hello? I think we
I was muted for just a moment there. I got a message to that effect. Can you hear me now?
Yes, absolutely. You're coming through.
Okay. Article 7 and 1 were just about the last to be revised. And what we found when we got to Article 7 was that the industries were far ahead of us. The shipping industries and the warehouse industries are using and were in 2003 using electronic documents. And what they wanted was were legal provisions that would put them on solid ground to make certain that that their documents were entirely effective. And probably courts would find them to be so, but the revisions to the UCC make that an absolute certainty. The charge to that drafting committee was to be very light. We have not thoroughly revised Article 7. We have changed it almost exclusively to deal with electronic documents and in a few other places to clear up ambiguities that had caused trouble. With regard to Article 1, as Terry indicated, is general provisions applicable to all the other articles. So the provisions of Article 1 are applicable to Article 7, Article 9, et cetera. And after 20 years of revisions, there was sort of a disconnect between some of the other articles and Article 1. Definitions had changed, new definitions had come in. And so the revision of Article 1 is primarily designed to sort of clean everything up and pull the Uniform Commercial Code together so it's a coherent whole. And Terry, I think, described the major changes in Article 1. So that's a little bit of background, and I'd like to be brief with that, so I'll stop there unless there are any questions.
Thank you, Professor Hennings. Are there any questions, Senator Thomas?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Hennings, in one area of the bill, it talks about the proceeds from the goods and possessions being sold. Is there something that I'm missing here that would determine, or somebody that determines the value of those goods, so that if there's a $1,000 bill owed and the carrier just decides to dispose of $10,000 worth of furniture, let's just say, just to get their $1,000, is there some claim or something that causes it to be a fair disposal of, so that the person whose goods that are being held are not just sold simply for the cost that is due the carrier?
That's a good question. There is not a specific procedure set up requiring commercially reasonable sales as you have on Article 7 foreclosures, but there are the general standards of the Uniform Commercial Code, which are good faith and commercial reasonableness. And commercial good faith of course is honesty, but commercial reasonableness means that you have to comport with standards of fairness that are consistent with what other similar entities would do in the commercial world. And so I have no doubt but that a court could come in and regulate that kind of conduct and treat a sale for a ridiculously small amount as something in the nature of a conversion. But is there a broad structure for that? Unless I'm forgetting something in Article 7, and that's always a possibility, it's not my primary area, I don't think so. There is no change here, though, by the way. The provisions on foreclosing the warehousemen's and the shippers' liens are the same as they've been in the code throughout.
Thank you.
Any further questions for Professor Hennings? Seeing none, we would thank Professor Henning. Are there any additional questions for Ms. Thurbin? Seeing none, thank you. Is there anyone in the audience that would wish to speak to the committee substitute for House Bill 102? Seeing none, is there anyone else online? There are none, so we will close public testimony on House Bill 102. I guess I would just add my take on this. Again, having completed law school and having the Uniform Commercial Code as one of my courses in law school, it's exactly what it means. It's a uniform code, and My understanding of this is it's just bringing Alaska up to the 21st century, so I think it's a good thing. So with that in mind, I would Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that the committee substitute for House Bill number 102, Judiciary /S, be moved from the our committee to the next committee of referral with individual recommendations, and I didn't see a fiscal note unless...
I don't believe there is a fiscal note.
I thought it's a zero.
If there is, it's a zero one. Yeah. So with the attached zero fiscal note.
Are there any objections? Seeing none, it is so moved. We will take a brief at ease for signing. We'll briefly come back, bring the meeting back on record for purposes of saying that we are adjourned, having completed our business for this April 14th, 2009. Thank you to the committee members. We are adjourned.